and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look back at the story in the news that defined the struggle between the better angels of our nature and the emerging dark side of America that exploded into the open this year in Charlottesville, Virginia. We'll begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from August the 21st, 2017, in which we offered insight into a new radical movement, Antifa, that has become the nemesis of the alt-right, who, along with the Fox echo chamber, have exaggerated the power and influence of a small group fighting back against well-funded right-wing provocateurs on campus and Nazis attacking and murdering citizens as they did in Charlottesville, Virginia. Mark Bray, an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street, joined us to discuss his latest book, Antifa, an anti-fascist handbook. We examined the rise of white supremacy and neo-Nazism around the world following recent demonstrations in Warsaw, Poland, and surveyed the history of anti-fascism from its origins to the present day. While critics say shutting down adversaries is anti-democratic, Antifa activists argue that the horrors of fascism must never be allowed to triumph again, especially with Donald Trump in the White House, who is enacting his authoritarian tendencies at home while displaying affection and solidarity with despots abroad. Then we'll go to a broadcast of Background Briefing from August the 24th, 2017, analyzing the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest, about his latest book, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. We discussed Trump's alarming response to the recent disgrace of neo-Nazis descending on Thomas Jefferson's hometown and Jefferson's warning that an ignorant people cannot remain a free people in the context of a failing education system and growing civic ignorance compounded by social media that has given rise to our Kardashian culture. And joining us now is Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Bray.
Thank you for having me.
And the Antifa apocalypse didn't happen in the way that the right wing had built this up and even talked about the Antifa super soldiers that would create a civil war in the United States on November the 4th, what, a couple of Saturdays ago. So is this a problem in terms of any political organization in the United States, that we are so much a culture that is motivated by Manichaeanism? Because it seems to me that the right in this country have all the money, have all these bilious billionaires supporting them, like David Horowitz, and we know that Stephen Bannon gets supported by the Mercers, etc. And yet they have to frame themselves as being beleaguered and
right,
up against this huge tide of socialist or Sharia takeover of the country. So
right,
let's begin with that kind of context. Are we sort of hopelessly Manichaean?
Well, I think you're certainly right that the way that these fascist and white supremacist and alt-right groups portray themselves as the really the ultimate victim, the kinds of privileges of being, you know, the patriarchal white male Christian conservative that have been eaten away by generations of social struggle. These identities are beleaguered, and they're trying to mischaracterize movements for feminism or queer and trans liberation or racial justice in order to portray themselves as the ones who are being under attack. This erroneous notion of white genocide, for example, and the irony is that they are trying to re-instantiate the kinds of domination that these movements have been fighting against, and there is a kind of Manichaean perspective that they're trying to put forward, but I think that really, regardless of people's politics or perspectives, I think there's room for all people in all walks of life to denounce fascist and white supremacist perspectives, and that really they are far outside of what most people think.
Well, but I think they've gotten even scarier because they're no longer these tattooed skinheads on motorbikes. They all look like accountants now and business managers. They've, you know, this guy Spencer wears business suits and looks like a junior corporate executive.
Right, right. I mean, certainly there's an effort to take a page out of the French New Right and out of the page of those who have come before, like David Duke, who tried to segue from being in Klan robes to being to wearing a suit in office to try and present a kind of quote-unquote respectable, middle-class, educated perspective on what they're trying to sort of rebrand as white nationalism, even though it's really basically just a wrinkle on traditional white supremacist perspectives. And I think that that really gives some insight into how fascist and white supremacist politics try to grow by making their perspectives seem everyday and family-friendly and innocuous, and why it's so important to protest these groups and to prevent these ideas from becoming normalized. And so certainly the tiki torch-wielding, khaki-wearing neo-Nazis that showed up in Virginia are a really strong example of that. Also, anti-racist researchers have pointed out that these groups and individuals do also have connections to your sort of stereotypical skinhead neo-Nazi kind of biker milieu as well. So it's sort of more of a continuity in that way.
Well, since you've studied human rights terrorism and political radicalization in modern Europe, what did you make of the demonstrations that took place the weekend before last in Warsaw, Poland? 60,000-plus people showed up. It was a massive demonstration. And they were talking about clean blood and white Europe, and even chanting Sieg Heil in a country where the worst Nazi atrocities were committed.
Right, yeah. I visited Poland 3 or 4 years ago and visited a lot of the sites of the former ghettos, and it was really appalling to see all the white supremacist graffiti that was still scrolled across these walls. Certainly, there's a struggle going on across Europe for the kind of soul of what this region will look like in the future. Will it become multicultural? Will it become multi-religious? Will it welcome in immigrants and refugees and Muslims and so forth? Or will it try to turn back the tide to an imagined purity that never really existed? Certainly this is especially violent and especially dangerous in parts of Eastern Europe, parts of the Balkans, but it is a problem that stretches across the continent, and groups from all different countries were there. Richard Spencer, I think, planned, I read, to show up, but the Polish authorities wouldn't let him into the country. So, you know, the struggles of the 30s and 40s may seem distant, but there are places where it's very real, and I think that's why we really need to take this threat seriously.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalization in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. It is a bit ironic, though, isn't it, Mark, that the victims of fascism in the 30s and 40s, the Jewish diaspora, along with, of course, the gypsies and infirm people, etc. But nowadays, it seems that even though they're still anti-Semitic, they seem to be more anti-Muslim than anything. That seems to animate the European fascists.
Right, right. And it's indicative of shifts over time. We can see even that when the far right reemerged in Europe in the 40s and 50s and 60s, there was a shift towards focusing on anti-Semitism, towards focusing on new waves of migration from the Caribbean, from South Asia, from Turkey in the case of Germany. And so, far-right politics, fascist politics have a kind of flexibility in terms of finding who the other is that will be the reflection of their argument that they represent the true nation or the true race. And at the moment, they're trying to tap into fears about terrorism, fears about outsiders and refugees and immigrants, and also in some cases, in some really bizarre ways, trying to tap into a kind of progressive animal rights perspective by trying to do anti-halal events under the guise of being pro-animal rights, or pro-LGBTQ perspectives by trying to demonize Muslims as allegedly being homophobic. And so I think it really shows how we need to have all of our politics in conversation with each other and be intersectional and holistic and not just let one issue stand in for the whole.
Well, let's talk about your handbook. Now, to get a perspective on the handbook, it does make sense to sort of do a quick sort of sketch of the history of anti-fascism. Obviously, the fascists were triumphant in the Spanish Civil War in Italy, and then in Germany, and piled up, 50, 60 million corpses in their wake until they were finally defeated. But all along, there were anti-fascists. Of course, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of American idealists on the left were often referred to as premature anti-fascists. So just begin, if you will, at the beginning of this rather largely untold story.
Right, right. So when fascism emerged, it emerged as, among other things, a violent reaction, a wave of revolutionary upheaval in Italy, in Germany, and elsewhere. And so fascists who claimed to be acting in the interest of the Italian nation, for example, were confronted by militant anti-fascists in a formation called the Arditi del Popolo, which included anarchists and communists and socialists and all kinds of leftists. Likewise, in Germany, the communists and socialists formed groups that fought back against the Nazis. But it's interesting that really when Hitler took power in 1933, communist and socialist leadership didn't realize how dangerous of a threat it was. And so your reference to the Spanish Civil War is very important because that's really the first moment that the European left as a whole and arguably the global left really realized that they were in a struggle for existence against an enemy that wanted to destroy them completely. What people don't realize, though, is that after Hitler, Mussolini, and so forth were defeated in World War II, the far right in Europe slumbered, and it came out of hiding gradually over the course of the following decades, as we discussed, trying to tap into xenophobic and anti-immigrant perspectives, more recently anti-Muslim perspectives. And there's also been an effort to try and distance the rhetoric from the explicit fascist and Nazi past, even though there are documented lineages between them and the National Front, for example, in France and in other groups, and try to present this respectable party politics image, which has raised interesting questions for resistance and how to push back when these groups are tapping into large-scale frustrations with the prevailing left parties or with the welfare state.
But in terms of the political spectrum, Antifa and anarchists are often conflated as being on the left. And if you talk about the Spanish Civil War, I recall from reading George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia that the anarchists were being persecuted and killed as much by Stalin's people as they were by Franco's fascists.
That's entirely correct, yeah. So part of the tragedy of the 20s, 30s, and 40s is that most of the European left could not actually successfully get on the same page to fight the common enemy. There was a brief window of time in the beginning of the Spanish Civil War when it seemed like all of the left groups were united, but what happened very quickly was the left unity fragmented into, largely speaking, two coalitions. One were the anarchists, Trotskyists, George Orwell, and his comrades, who were in favor of pursuing a social revolution in addition to fighting the war, and then that pitted them against the Stalinists and their allies, who were in favor of essentially returning the upper class to their position, putting off the class struggle in the interest of fighting the civil war, as they phrased it. And essentially, it was a way for Stalinists to pursue Trotskyists and anarchists and any kind of dissident socialists, and they were really much more preoccupied on that goal than fighting the war. There's been some interesting documents that uncovered over the years about how Stalin was really much more interested in this internal left struggle than fighting the war. So it's a tragic history, and that's why post-war anti-fascists have done what they can, not always successfully, to try and put differences aside, recognizing that there is a threat that faces all of us.
Let's take a brief station break. We're back continuing the conversation.
Taylor. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know. Poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose.
Welcome back. We are continuing the conversation with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe. He was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street. And his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. Well, let's move to the Antifa and of course, your new book, Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And I suppose most people in the audience and in the country first heard of Antifa as a result of what happened in Charlottesville. I think that's pretty much when it sort of first emerged as a phenomenon. And I recall at the time, or shortly thereafter, talking to a couple of Jewish students. They were in yeshiva school, and they were in linking arms with Dr. Cornel West and others. And the police basically were hands off. They let the fascists, you know, chanting blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, except they literally had a phalanx of these fascists moving on them, and they were totally vulnerable. And this yeshiva student that I interviewed said, you know, we were saved by Antifa. So that gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? That, you know, you can't basically lock hands and sing kumbaya to these thugs who have guns and clubs and will beat the hell out of you.
Yeah, I mean, there is no one-size-fits-all way to organize against the far right, and I think there's a wide variety of strategies and tactics that listeners can turn to try and make a difference. But it is true that when you counter-protest white supremacists and fascists, there's a very good chance that they're going to be violent against you, and you need to be ready for that. And so that's partly the anti-fascist perspective, is to be ready for that and to really make an argument that it's not a question of if white supremacists and fascist groups will be violent. It's a question of when. And if we don't take it seriously from the very start, we'll run the risk of letting these groups grow to the point where their violent perspectives are normalized, everyday people pick them up, and marginalized populations feel the brunt of that in a way that often mainstream society is not as attuned to and looks the other way. And so that's really sort of the crux of the politics, and certainly the statements made by Cornel West and other clergy and some of the students you mentioned that anti-fascists really saved them from violent neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, I think gets to the core of what this is about.
Well, obviously, the way that it's that Donald Trump himself tried to say there were good peoples on both sides and use the Antifa as an excuse for, I think, his essentially covert sympathy for the right and for his own authoritarian tendencies. But the press also, to my mind, plays a role in basically equating Antifa with the Nazis. And I think it probably comes out of this binary convention in our press that in the universe of discourse, there's two equal and opposite opinions. You know, the black and white idea, if you talk to a Republican, you have to talk to a Democrat. If you talk, you know, the reductio absurdum is if you talk to a Holocaust survivor, you have to talk to a Holocaust denier. But it has enabled creationism to be equated with evolution, and it's allowed the denial of global warming, faux science, to be equated with real science. So it is something that bothers me as a journalist, coming out of a different tradition, you know, from the BBC, for example, where you don't have to pretend that you're the piano player in the whorehouse. You try to be as fair as possible, but there's no point in hiding who you are. That's dishonest.
Right. And so certainly the media narrative covering fascism and anti-fascism from perhaps the counter-protest against Milo Yiannopoulos at Berkeley back in February up through Trump's comments about good people on both sides were that essentially the both sides were equivalent. It was a focus that refuse to actually focus on the values and politics and histories and context that underpin why fascists are violent and why anti-fascists feel compelled to defend themselves. Then there was, of course, a brief window of time when the media pushed back against Trump's moral equivalency, and you had figures like Mitt Romney and so forth saying there is no moral equivalency, but then the media cycle needed a new hot take, and then there were articles that came out saying, yes, there is a moral equivalency, there are bad people on both sides. Ultimately, what I try to emphasize is no action can be evaluated in the absence of its motivations and its consequences and its history. And so people can agree or disagree about the ethical status of self-defense, the efficacy of confronting and counter-protesting these groups, but to say that the kind of self-defense, for example, of the anti-fascists in Charlottesville was of the same variety as the fascists who were trying to attack black people and Jews and so forth is really absurd. And as you said, it's that kind of journalistic neutrality where journalists feel emboldened to be normatively descriptive about politics that are outside of the norm, especially on the left, but often treat the right with kid gloves. So it's very disturbing, and certainly the media have done a poor job covering this for the reasons we mentioned, and also for the kind of really lack of foundational information on what anti-fascism is.
But, of course, the demonstrations that took place at the inauguration in the streets of Washington, I watched those in real time as they were filmed, and I don't think there's any way that you can suggest that the average American didn't think that that was pretty appalling behavior.
Certainly right. It was an unpopular action that most Americans don't understand or agree with. But I think, if I could try to play devil's advocate and do my best to explain the perspective as I understand it of the organizers, it was to say that if you have someone walking into the White House who many people say is a fascist or is fascistic, whose actions will inevitably result in death from people losing their health insurance, destruction of the planet, and so forth, then certainly the way that we protest and the way that we resist should correspondingly be elevated. We should pull the emergency brake. We should make it clear that this is a crisis. To me, that was part of the motivation of the people who committed targeted property destruction. But returning to our previous conversation, certainly I think there's a world of difference between breaking window panes versus breaking people's bones. And that's certainly an important thing to keep in mind. And not that you are going down the road of moral equivalency, but some people do.
Well, so can you break the movement down, Antifa, into a defensive movement or an offensive movement? Is it possible to be defensive and not offensive?
Good question. So based on my research, and the book is based on interviews with approximately 60 anti-fascists from 17 different countries in Europe and North America, the perspective, as I understand it, is understanding self-defense in two ways. One, in an immediate sense, which is more common sense, that in every era of anti-fascist organizing, groups and movements have grown in response to violent neo-Nazi groups and skinhead groups and so forth. So self-defense in an immediate sense. But also many put forward a perspective of self-defense in a preemptive sense, which is, returning to a conversation we had earlier, refusing to accept the proposition that white supremacist or fascist organizing can happen in the absence of violence. It's an argument that it's only a matter of when, not if, and for stopping these groups before they grow. That having been said, though, the perspective that I got from my interview subjects was that most of the time they accomplish this through nonviolent methods, by figuring out through research where far-right groups are going to have their events, contacting venue owners to shut them down, finding out what web servers host websites for the far-right, and pressuring them to ban them, and that happened quite successfully after Charlottesville, where a lot of web servers got rid of these neo-Nazi sites based on public pressure. But sometimes it entails counter-protesting and sometimes confronting these far-right groups and being ready for the violence that inevitably comes through. And so that kind of preemptive self-defense is a kind of paradox that some people struggle with. But I think if we think through the historical ramifications of where these politics lead, if they're allowed to flourish, I think that's the kind of context that's necessary to understand where anti-fascists are coming from.
But in terms of the Antifa tactic known as no platforming, which is to deny these alt-right fascists their opportunity to speak in public, and we've seen that on campuses, particularly at Berkeley and also down in Florida recently. I've spoke with Erwin Chemerinsky at the time. He's a dean of the law school at Berkeley. And what bothered him, it wasn't so much Antifa, it's the tactics of the David Horowitzes and the Milo Yiannopouloses and Breitbart and Bannon, etc., that essentially what they're all about is seeking publicity and, more importantly, seeking martyrdom, going back to our original discussion, or the beginning of our discussion, and that is that the right has to have this kind of martyrdom complex, even though they're all funded by billionaires and basically are extorting attention in a form of terrorism. But their real tactic, at least this is what Irwin was saying, is to basically bankrupt the public education. I mean, that they are causing these public universities to spend an enormous amount of money, but their real hope is that they will be banned. Then they can become martyrs. So how much is Antifa paying into that, in the sense that these right-wing groups really want is to be banned from speaking on campuses so that they can say, see, we're martyrs of free speech and the left are a bunch of, you know, they're censoring us. Political correctness is the scourge that's overtaking America.
Right. Well, I think that fascists and white supremacists and alt-right provocateurs certainly thrive to be the victim, and they'll be the victim no matter what happens. And so certainly you're right to touch upon the question of political correctness, and that has an especially important relevance in the context of the university. So, you know, in a classroom when a professor insists on feminist discourses, on using the pronouns that students choose, pushing back against kind of racist statements in classrooms, these feminist and anti-racist and queer and trans liberation perspectives are the kind of fundamental battleground that the far right feels like they are being excluded from. But of course, it's really just them crying about the loss of their traditional privileges and forms of domination. When it comes to tactics, I think that it's important to understand that far right movements grow not entirely dissimilarly from how left movements grow. You need to have public events, you need to embed movements in communities, you need to disseminate messages, you need to become normalized, you have to have your perspectives become common sense. And by preventing these individuals and groups from having their events, I think it may, in the short term, give them more public attention. But in the long run, I think it short circuits their ability to translate that into a movement and into a kind of establishment or institution in society. So even if you take the case of Milo, certainly he got a lot of attention when he was shut down in Berkeley, but subsequently a lot of universities have used the excuse of the kind of protester, counter-protester chaos to try and ban him on considerations of security. When Milo tried to have an event in Arizona, he contacted 62 different venues who all refused him because they didn't want to deal with it. Overall, the attention brought up his pro-pedophilia comments. He was hired by the Daily Caller for one day before he was fired because even at the far-right Daily Caller, his presence was untenable. And so in that way, I think that these kinds of protest tactics and movements may generate some attention in the short term, but over time, it's a diminishing marginal return. And on the other side, we're building a strong anti-racist movement that is ready to use direct action methods to prevent these groups from growing. So I think that it's important. Let's check in on figures like Milo, Richard Spencer, the prospects of the far right, 6 months from now, a year from now, and I'm optimistic that their ability to actually translate these heinous ideas into popular movements will not be able to advance.
Let's talk a little bit about what you refer to as liberal anti-fascism, and that, I think, is a part of a broader issue of the idea from the Gospel of St. John that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, which is, I think, the sort of trap. I know George Lakoff at Berkeley talks about this in terms of the way the right is very effective at framing arguments, whereas the left is always very deficient in that regard. And that the assumption is that if you have the most reasonable argument, you therefore win. And that is not working in this post-truth America we have, where there is no consensus about what is true and what is real anymore. And that is a scary fact. So you have so many people living inside the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair, Limbaugh bubble, and Trump tells them that to believe him, and which they do, and that everything else is fake news. So there seems to be a sort of a connection there, in as much as, you know, How do you get beyond the idea that by simply being reasonable and having the best source intellectual argument, that somehow, I mean, I know it's a, this is a vestige of the Age of Enlightenment, but it's not working. And I struggle with that because I wish there was a way to prick the Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble and get to these people, because they're all being conned by this total fraud that they voted for, Donald Trump.
Right, right. So certainly you're right to trace this to Enlightenment thinking in the perspective that in an open confrontation, truth will always defeat error. But that kind of modernist optimism, I think, was never really grounded in reality and was, I think, largely shattered by the kind of events of that we're really talking about, the Holocaust, World War II, the perspective that things don't always get better. Certainly, I think that discourse and argumentation are super important. It's super important to have conversations like this and to try and convince people of the righteousness of being anti-racist and feminist and so forth. But I think that any kind of discourse operates in the context of power and the ability to push back against far-right movements and to really build successful popular movements to build a better world rely on meeting people's needs, recognizing how in times of economic crisis they're going to look for solutions, and if their needs aren't met by the left, they aren't met by labor unions or by working in their communities, they're going to blame immigrants, they're going to turn to demagogues who are going to promise to reverse the entire tide of neoliberalism by bringing jobs back to the United States, which is impossible. And so I think it's important to kind of think of a multi-tiered, multi-layered strategy that includes argumentation, includes discourse and rationality, but also incorporates organizing, building bridges in communities, and trying to build a better world. And when it comes to dealing with the far right, certainly I think we can see even in the presidential election that at a sort of mainstream level, the right kinds of arguments were made about why Donald Trump was full of it, but nevertheless, a lot of people supported him anyway, and he ended up winning the election. So I don't think it's enough to simply make the argument. It's also important to figure out why people are hurting, organize to try to make a better world, and for people who simply aren't going to respond to that, try to prevent far-right and racist ideas from taking the mainstream position, and that entails organizing. It entails getting out there. That's been true in the past. It's true today, and it's why we need to really take a holistic look at this, I'd say.
Well, Mark Bray, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Bray, who's an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe, who was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street and is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He's the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and his latest book just out is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And that was from Background Briefing, August the 21st, 2017. We'll take a brief break, then be back with more Background Briefing's alt-right coverage from 2017 with an interview on August the 24th on the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America. Welcome back to a retrospective of Background Briefing's coverage of the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America. Let's now go to a broadcast from August the 24th. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire distinguished scholar in critical pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Henry. And let's start with the broadest possible landscape in the sense that, are we still a democracy? Have we crossed the Rubicon into plutocracy? Because it seems to me that you could make the case that not just plutocrats run America, but just three plutocrats seem to dominate our government. The two Koch brothers obviously have the Congress doing their bidding, and we have one billionaire, Robert Mercer, and his daughter, who seem to, at least they're the biggest donors to Trump and clearly have some influence over him. So where would you place us in that sense, whether we're still a democracy?
No, I don't think we're a democracy at all. I mean, I think that, and what's increasingly disturbing about the fact that we're no longer a democracy is that there's no longer an attempt to defend the notion that we might be a democracy. I mean, I think that what we have seen increasingly over the past few years, and especially under Trump, is a switch in the language. And it's a switch that speaks to the need to define, in some ways, democracy without any substance. And I think that, in other words, there's no attempt, there's increasingly less of an attempt to justify what we see in terms of policies or what we see in terms of ideology or what we see in terms of social practices in the name of democracy. Trump rarely ever mentions the word democracy, as you well know. It's almost completely absent from his speeches. And I think that what we're seeing in Trump is evidence of what we're witnessing all over the world, which is a worldwide rejection of liberal democracy itself. And I think that it's being replaced with a kind of populist authoritarianism that is, in a sense, very comfortable now with defining itself precisely as that. So rather than saying it's a democracy, I mean, we're now saying, hey, look, we need strong rule, we need strong leaders, we need people basically who are going to preserve a sense of cultural nationalism. So all the markers for an anti-democratic society are now being touted in ways in which even the discourse of democracy is no longer used to legitimate those markers.
So in other words, we've seen democracy be rolled back in the Philippines under Duterte, who's busily murdering people that he doesn't like. There's an example. Are we similar to the Philippines without extrajudicial murders going on?
I think that we're closer to places like Modi's India and closer to Putin's Russia. I mean, I think that, and Orban's Hungary and Duda in Poland. I mean, I think that these countries are really similar to what we're seeing happening in the United States. I think that Duterte is the end point of the most extreme versions of this type of authoritarianism. But I think that when you have a president of the United States basically defending the actions of neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and white nationalists, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, in what way has the language changed so as to suggest that the very nature of power itself has changed? And I think in that sense, yeah, we are in that moment of populist authoritarianism, which is enormously dangerous. I mean, certainly we can't point to elections. I mean, I guess the real question might be, you know, what are the measures that you want to point to that suggest that a democracy even exists in this country? Do you want to point to elections? They're bought and sold. You know, you have the Koch brothers. I mean, you know, they don't believe in elections being democratic. I mean, the basic economic, political, and cultural institutions of the United States are now largely driven by corporations. You have the AFL-CIO leader actually joined a presidential commission under a guy who basically is as anti-labor as you can possibly get. So I guess the question here, where are the markers of democracy? I mean, how would you measure that now? How would you talk about democracy outside of certain limited freedoms that basically are as empty as the word itself?
Well, the countries that you mentioned that we're more like in terms of the drift into authoritarianism, Hungary, Poland, and Russia, in all cases, the way that the country was essentially taken over by Putin and Orban and the Kaczynski brother, the first thing they did was take over the media. So we do seem to have a kind of ministry of truth in this country developing with Fox, and Murdoch apparently speaks to Trump almost every day. Sinclair is now about to be made even more powerful than it is, and will be in every home across the country just about. And then you've got these minor, lesser players like Breitbart and Drudge, and of course you've got wackos like Alex Jones out there, who apparently the president actually believes and listens to. So is that an indicator in terms of what you're suggesting?
Yes, it is. And it's an important point that you're making, because I think at one level, what it suggests, if you compare those groups to other groups like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you know, one might say, well, wait a minute, you know, you do have this press that now is basically pushing back against Trump. But what Trump has done is that rather than simply shut down the media, he's discredited the media and harassed them to such a degree that the notion that in many ways he's convinced a large part of the American public that they're nothing more than an expression of fake news. I mean, he's done something actually more pronounced and, in my estimation, far more powerful than any of these other nations. I mean, he's created a tweet nation. This is a nation of tweet. And he excludes them. He excludes them through his tweets. He excludes them through a cultural war in which he realizes that the power of ideas don't always work simply in the interest of resistance. That ideas can be used to basically, in some way, create a kind of collective hysteria and massive sense of fear that results in many ways a shift in sympathies away from the call for democracy to the symbolic necessity of what we might call strongman leaders, authoritarian types like Trump. So I think in that sense, he's far more sophisticated. I think the United States is far more sophisticated in polluting what we might call the discourse of freedom, collaboration, and dissent.
Well, Donald Trump would never have been elected president in this country but for the $5 billion of free media that the mainstream media gave him. I'm sure they're trying to redeem themselves now, but that's an inescapable fact, is it not, Henry?
Well, I think it is an inescapable fact. Inescapable in the sense that they're trying to redeem themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, that they gave him $5 billion worth.
Yeah, of course. And they readily admit that.
Yeah.
And they played a central role, of course, in Trump's election. But I think what that points to is, particularly in the United States, is that the economic crisis was never matched by a crisis of ideas. So that you didn't have, alternative public spheres such as what you do and what others do, who were really able to expose Trump and all the contradictions for what he was worth, rather than playing into this politics of theatrics and distraction that really is what drives the press. I mean, the press, the corporate press, the mainstream press, is really about ratings. It's not about the search for truth. I mean, why is it that every reporter who's reading off a teleprompter today is 25 years old and looks as if they've just won a beauty contest somewhere? I mean, you know, it's pretty clear that politics has turned into a pathology that now organizes itself almost entirely around questions of money and aesthetics. It's a spectacle.
And again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. Now, of course, you mentioned Charlottesville, where the Nazis descended upon Thomas Jefferson's hometown. Recently, a young woman was murdered, and Trump, of course, said there were fine people on both sides, which he's obviously trying to get out from under that. He even lied about it the other night at a rally in Phoenix. It omitted what he'd really said. But what I find extraordinary, and particularly when I see these crowds, there's an African-American guy that's always been at all of his rallies. It's got an amazingly long rap sheet for all kinds of cult activities and capital crimes, and yet he shows up at every Trump event. This whole tawdry scene from day one is absolutely extraordinary, and to see him in this kind of bread and circuses mode. Even, by the way, even his own people started to drift off because he was just repeating himself like a madman. But it reminds me, given that Thomas Jefferson Town was recently, Charlottesville was invaded by the Nazis, that Jefferson famously said, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people. And you're a specialist in pedagogy. Is that at the heart of our problem, is the collapse of public education?
I mean, I think you can't have a democracy without informed citizens, right? I mean, that's John Dewey. That's Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt said, if you really want to understand fascism, you have to understand something. It's really about what she calls thoughtlessness. You know, the ability to create the conditions in which people lose their capacity to think and to be able to hold power accountable. And I think that, you know, just look at the recent statistics that have come out about the Republican Party that is shocking. I mean, almost 50% of all Republicans now believe that if Trump refused to hold elections in 2020, they would go along with that. Over 50% of all Republicans now believe that higher education is more of a curse than a benefit. Increasingly, in a number of Republican states, they're criminalizing the possibility of protest. Higher education is being defunded. Public schools are being privatized. The media basically, we have Betsy DeVos, who is really, you know, comparable to an idiot, you know, who's now running the Department of Education and hates public education. You have Jeff Sessions, you know, who is really the great white hope of white nationalists. And then, of course, you have this thing with Charlottesville and the kind of press that it gets. But what nobody wants to talk about is that you live in a country that's rooted in such ignorance that even the dream of the Confederacy never dies. That, you know, that's constantly being reproduced. Couple that with the war being waged against women, against young people, against transgender people, against gays, against labor, and the attack on education, and you begin to realize that people cannot basically translate private issues into larger public concerns. That's why this attack on education has been going on for over 40 years. 40 years. You can go right back to the Powell memo. When they were very, very clear, Lewis Powell was very clear writing for the Chamber of Commerce. He said if the right wants to win, it has to win the battle of ideas. And they understood that, and they built think tanks, and they built, you know, all these private institutions that now create their own public intellectuals. This is one of the few countries in the world in which most of the intellectuals we now hear in the media are anti-public intellectuals. They're not public intellectuals. They're anti-public intellectuals. And in some cases, especially under Trump, Ian, as you well know, especially a guy as sophisticated and as smart as you are, you know, you listen to these people talk, they're like babbling idiots. You think, oh, my God. I mean, you know, where do they find these people? I mean, do they have a high – I mean, they should revoke their high school diplomas. I mean, these are people that are that stupid for whom the truth is meaningless. And that the real issue here is to create a fog of ignorance that would not enable people to, in a sense, act on their own sense of agency as critical citizens. And I think you're right. That's at the core of the problem. Now, you couple that with a celebrity culture that confers enormous authority in the country and mimics almost every aspect of neoliberal ideology. The competition, the rugged individualism, only one person left on the island, this kind of warlike militancy that drives the collective fantasies, you know, these revenge fantasies that now sort of permeate every aspect of the culture. These are not just political issues. These are educational issues because they're really about the creation of particular kinds of subjects, subjects that are comfortable finding themselves living in an authoritarian society.
Well, that's the curse, I think, of social media. You could paraphrase Winston Churchill's Battle of Britain admonition. Never before in the field of human activity has so much been said by so many about so little.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think for me as an educator and somebody who worked with Paulo Freire for over 20 years, and I remember he used to say, if you really want, in a sense, to create a culture of conformity and passivity and a culture of powerlessness, lead people to believe that they're responsible for their own problems. that there are no systemic problems. There are no larger social problems. Lead people to believe that the hopelessness and the despair that they find can only be solved in the image of some symbolic strongman who somehow will make up for their own deficiencies and all of a sudden then make the appeals and produce the ideologies necessary to turn what we might call protest into a kind of enormous rage and hatred that both is cleansing and at the same time employs the spectacle of violence.
Well, you've got the combination of social media and people retreating into their iPhones and not having any more human contact or less and less human contact. You've got education being destroyed by a two-front war, the libertarian Koch brothers on the one hand attacking public education out of their peculiar ideology, and then you've got Christian fundamentalists like Betsy DeVos who refer to public schools as government schools and feel that they indoctrinate kids into Marxism instead of teaching them Christianity and Genesis. And here in Los Angeles now, there are billboards all over the city celebrating, you know, against evolution, this anti-evolution idea of celebrating the book of Genesis. So it is a very peculiar time. But your new book, Henry Giroux, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, after having basically told us what is wrong, your book's tells us what we can do. So let's walk through some of your points there, because I don't want to leave people in despair.
No. I think we have to remember something. I mean, you know, power is not simply about domination. You know, it's also about resistance. It's also about hope. It's also about, in some way, confronting the issues that we need to confront in order to basically not feel alone and isolated and to join with others to collectively address some of the issues that are bearing down on our lives. One of the good things that we see in the midst of all this ignorance is that, you know, there are many people who don't buy this. I mean, you know, you have especially young people. I mean, I'm just so enamored with the resistance I see collectively on the part of young people all over the country, you know, who refuse to buy this anti-gay nonsense, you know, who refuse to buy into the bigotry and the stupidity and the ignorance, and who are very hip in many ways around this new technology and knowing how to use it and are able to make connections that often aren't made, whether we're talking about the Black Lives Movement or we're talking about non-revolution, the Bernie Sanders movement. And I think that where all of this has to really gives us hope is that I really don't believe that there's any hope in the Democratic Party. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party has reached its limits in terms of what it can do. It's the party of finance, and I think that young people are really raising the question, what will politics look like in the 21st century that not only includes our voices and our hopes and our aspirations and our dreams, but reinvents a future that is modeled after a kind of democratic socialism and not after a notion of neoliberalism that parades as democracy. And I think that once we can bring these various social movements together, as crucial as they are, under the umbrella of a radical socialist democracy, I think things will happen. I mean, I think we're seeing it happen. The contradictions are too great, and the assaults are too withering. You know, I mean, it's people are going to lose health care. I mean, people basically are going to find themselves in places they've never found before, because this is an authoritarian regime that has not only separated social costs from any sense of economic activity, but is immersed in the politics of cruelty and a culture of cruelty in which it sees compassion as a liability rather than as an asset. I have more faith in people than I do in that ideology. And I really believe that in the long run, we're going to see massive movements over the next 4 years emerging that give us a sense of hope and give us a sense of possibility.
Well, given the duopoly that we have, it's hard. You know, we know that third parties just don't make it, that the game is rigged against it. And you end up voting for the person who does you more harm than good, because of the way the system is rigged, as has happened a couple of times with Nader in Florida, and then recently with Jill Stein.
Yeah, but I'm not really arguing that route. I'm arguing something very different. I'm saying you have to have a long-term strategy. Right. You have to have a short-term strategy. You have to have one foot in and one foot out. And right. We push the Democratic Party as far as it can go in order to make sure that gains can be made that give people a touch and a glimpse of what would be possible outside of the Democratic Party. At the same time, you begin the long march through the institutions, the long-term organizing that's going to have to take place at community levels around incarceration, around questions of public education, around the questions of the public good. It looks bleak when you put it that way because we don't really have a language that really embodies the kind of democratic struggles that we're talking about. And that language is in the midst of being reinvented. So, you know, I don't believe the White House is going to be charged tomorrow and everything is going to be changed. I'm not a romanticist in that sense. But I do believe that we have already seen models historically in Spain, in Portugal, and other places where the unimaginable actually happened. When social movements and labor movements and the new media and young people came together to reinvent a very different kind of politics.
Well,
and there's no reason why it can't happen in the United States.
Right. But what I was about to say was that the Democratic Party is an empty shell. They're having a crisis of fundraising. The Republicans are making money hand over fist. Nobody's donating to the Democratic Party. They're in a state of crisis. My sense is that if the Tea Party can take over the Republican Party, then the kind of people that you're talking about can take over this empty shell known as the Democratic Party.
I hope not.
Oh, well, then how else do you express yourself in a...
Oh, actually, wait, maybe I missed that. I mean, you're actually suggesting that a left version of the Tea Party could take over the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Because it's an empty shell.
No, I actually think that's one possibility, and I think it's an important possibility, but I think if they do take it over, they can't just simply restructure it. They've got to reinvent it around a vision that's very different from the Republican Party, the Democratic Party that we have now, right?
Of course. That's the whole point.
Henry, I am certainly not against that route. Believe me, you know, it's not just simply thunder or nothing, lightning and thunder or nothing else. I mean, I think whatever route we can use to be able to bring these groups together to develop a political formation that offers a real alternative language and challenge to this idiocy that we have now. Ian, it's going to get worse. I mean, this guy just jumps from one catastrophe to the next. And I think it's some, like you said at the beginning here of this conversation, you know, people the other night in Phoenix were walking out. Right. They got tired, right?
Yeah.
They're getting tired of this, the emptiness, the shallowness, the lies, the stupidity.
Right.
I mean, how much further can we go with this?
Right.
I mean, what degree does some of the claim to legitimacy have to take root, and where's it going to come from?
Right. Well, you know, it's an amazing situation that the United States, the leader of the free world, is a reality TV star, a racist, a bigot, a con artist, a delusional sociopath. It's just breathtaking that it's happened.
It's breathtaking.
And we all have to do what we can to undo this travesty. Well, Henry Giroux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian, anytime.
And again, Abby, speak with Henry Giroux, the world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy, and he writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism, Dangerous Thinking in Authoritarian Times, America at War with Itself, and his latest book just out is The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And that was an interview from Background Briefing, August 24th, 2017. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing's 2017 coverage of the emergence of the alt-right in Trump's America. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.